Today, the Capital Investment Committee for April 7th is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. Is being live streamed by the House Public Information Office. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Chair Lee.
Lee present.
Lee present. Vice Chair Murphy. Vice Chair Murphy. You're muted.
Well, no, her presence, Mr. Wilcox, you can go on.
You can come back. You represent Verdal?
Verdal present.
Verdal present. Representative Agbaje?
Present.
Agbaje present. Representative Berg?
Present.
Berg present. Representative Davids?
Davids present.
Davids present. Representative Frankie?
Frankie present.
Frankie present. Representative Freiberg?
Present.
Freiberg present. Representative Hansen?
Present.
Hansen present. Representative Hewitt?
Present.
Hewitt present. Representative Lilly?
Lilly present.
Lilly present. Representative Lucero?
Mr. Wilcox, you have another awesome outfit on.
Lucero present. Representative Moran?
Present.
Moran present. Representative Pearson?
Pearson present.
Pearson present. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh present.
Raleigh present. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen present.
Rasmussen present. Representative Ryer?
Ryer present.
Ryer present. Representative West?
West present.
West present. Representative Zhang?
Here.
Zhang present. And Vice Chair Murphy?
Murphy present without the annotated.
Murphy present.
Agenda.
Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. A quorum is present. Chair Murphy, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday, April 5th?
You certainly do, Mr. Chair. I move approval.
Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for Tuesday, April 5th. Any discussions, members? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for Tuesday, April 5th are approved. Members, really appreciate all of you hopping on for our early start today. All bills will be heard on an informational basis only with amendments offered for reference only. And with this, we'll start right off with House File 4565. Chair Becker Finn, please proceed.
Can you hear me, Mr. Chair? I am learning that apparently the lower level of the Capitol, the Wi-Fi is not great down here.
We can hear you. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a bill for my home community, for Leech Lake Nation, for a wellness center. This is something that honestly has been a dream of folks in our community for decades. And I really think the most important thing is that you hear directly from community members who have been working on this project. And so with that, I will hand it over to my testifiers.
First on the agenda, we have Chairman Jackson. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed. Chairman Jackson, if you're on, you're muted.
Apologize for that. Bonjour, good morning. My name is Farron Jackson Sr., and I am chairman of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I am honored to be here this morning. I would like to take some time to express our gratitude to the Capital Investment Committee and Chair Lee for inviting us to share our plans for the Leech Lake Area Health and Wellness Center. Our request for bonding appropriations for this project is reflected in House File 4565. I would also like to thank Representative Jamie Becker Finn for championing this project on our behalf. Jamie Gwitch, Jamie. Your dad would be proud. Capital investment and taking care of our people are important to him, and this is the perfect combination of both. Before I introduce our presenter, I need to underscore the importance of this project to Minnesotans who call the Leech Lake area and the city of Cass Lake home. This wellness center is a dream that has been waiting to become a reality for over a decade. We come before you today to request your assistance with making this happen for our community and, more importantly, our youth and elders. Our youth are counting on us to deliver opportunities to establish a strong foundation of lifetime health and wellness. We believe this wellness center is that opportunity, and we are asking you to help us deliver. I'm going to turn it over to Levi Brown now, who will provide some more details. I am available for questions after our testimony today or at any time in the future, so please don't hesitate to reach out to me. Miigwech.
Chairperson Brown, welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. Good morning, and thanks for the intro, Chairman Jackson. My name is Levi Brown. I've been the community kind of team lead for the Leech Lake the project team here for the Leech Lake Community Wellness Center. And I wanted to take the time that's allotted here today to share with you guys a little bit more details on how we put this together. But first, I want some key terms to kind of for this committee to take into as we're having this conversation, you're reviewing this bill is, you know, when we look at this, we look at the future. We're looking at preventive measures, hope, generational change, our project's community driven, and, you know, the physical awareness around, you know, our budgeting and our business plan that we've put together, the focus on the future, teaching our community and talking about our community story and changing our path, you know, the opportunities that come with a facility like this. At the same time, I want you to have the understanding that this project is shovel ready. You know, we have been working on this for over a decade. With that said, I have included some information that's there in your packets, but to understand the Leech Lake community, I think we really have to dive into, you know, the disparities that exist, you know, the diabetes, the mental health, the depression, you know, those impacts that are currently, you know, our people are experiencing. And I think when you look at that and you start, what does that mean to the governments around the area, including the tribal government? You have to really look at the numbers, look at those social and health numbers. Leech Lake's human health, our health and human service budget is roughly $43 million a year. Cass County spent $16 million on human health. Cass County's jail spent $2.9 million last year, a 4% increase from the year before. Cass County's out-of-home placement was $1.9 million for youth. And when we look at our other neighbor, Beltrami County, they spent roughly $27 million on human health and services. That's a total of $93 million all the governments are spending annually. And we don't, not a very limited amount is preventive care. And so today, this center we're going to talk about that I'm going to run you through here quickly is really just that. It's a 50,000 square foot wellness center. I'm going to share so you can have some image. I'm trying to give you a virtual tour as quick as possible here. But I want you all to be aware of how much work we have put into this and how proud of the center and the project we are. So if you're familiar with the area or not familiar, this is Cass Lake, the seventh largest lake in Minnesota. And I mean, this is our project site with, for the first time ever, our community will, you know, be accessing the lakeshore from this southern part of the lake. And when I mean our community, that's tribal and non-tribal. Our community is made up of tribal members and non-tribal members. And so very proud of that site plan. But more importantly, I wanted to share with you what is included and then the vision that we have and how we want to share things, not only externally, but internally within our community when we're talking about pride and health in the community. And so,
Chair Brown, can I have you wrap up, please?
Okay, yep. And so I just wanted to give you guys this visual. We'll have all of the stuff we have here. The programming, we're looking for all of our partners, Boys and Girls Club, school districts, all that. With that said, I will just ask for your support that this investment is made in our community. And, you know, it's in the larger picture, it's a small investment. We hope that you all can be part of it. Any questions you have, please feel free to ask.
Thanks. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And sorry if I missed this, but I got a phone call that came in that I had to take too. But how much are you asking for?
Chair Brown.
Representative Erdahl, we'll be looking for $25 million, and we will be handling all of the annual operations and maintenance costs, board programming costs. We would take care of all of that with our partners and ourselves.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. And what is the total cost of what you're doing?
Chair Brown.
Currently, our estimated cost for the project to be built right now would be roughly about $29 million. The annual operation cost would be $700,000.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one follow-up comment. I mean, I think that these are valuable programs. I've been involved in a couple, in fact, one in my home area right now. I understand that there was a turning over of your board in the recent election. Is that the new board have the same commitment?
Chair Brown.
We have no reason, because the board is elected by the people. And when we look at our community needs this has been something, a campaign promise for all of our elected officials, and we have committed well over $1 million currently to the project. So we are invested as a community.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for those comments. That's important to know, and I'm glad that you're moving forward with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin, for your presentation. Next up on the agenda, House File 4726, Representative Scott.
Good morning, Capital Investment Team. It's good to be with you this morning. I'll get right to it. In July 2021, 1,4-dioxane, a possible carcinogen, was detected in a number of wells in Andover, and that led the MPCA to do an organized testing plan throughout the affected, where they feel the affected contaminated wells were. And in the meantime, the owners of those properties where the 1,4-dioxane was above the Minnesota Department of Health safety levels, those folks have been drinking bottled water since that time, and will have to continue drinking bottled water until we get city water hookups. And so that's what this project is doing. It's $9 million to do that. And I'd like to introduce the mayor of Andover now, Sherry Buckula.
Mayor Buckula, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning. I'm Andover Mayor Sherry Buckula. As Representative Scott just mentioned, this has been a 9-month kind of nightmare for this neighborhood. Just give you a little brief history of the city. It was incorporated as a city in 1974. The city's current population is approximately 30,000, with close to 11,000 households. Of those 11,000 households, 6,950 are connected to the city of Andover's municipal water supply, and 7,800 are connected to the municipal sewer system. The city of Andover has both urban and rural lots. Since the incorporation of the city in 1974, any newer development within the municipal urban service area has been constructed with municipal water and sewer. Rural lots conforming to the city comprehensive plan are still developed with private wells and septic systems. Areas of the community within the current MUSA boundary that existed before the municipal water system existed would have been developed with a private well and would likely continue to have a private well yet today. The Minnesota Department of Health would have permitted those private wells, and any new replacement updated wells would also be permitted by the Minnesota Department of Health. The Red Oaks neighborhood, the subject of this bonding request, was platted in 1967 to 1969. As part of Grow Township before the city of Andover was incorporated. The Red Oaks neighborhood is near the waste disposal engineering closed landfill managed by the MPCA, and to the south, Andover Superfund site under EPA oversight. Both sites are being reviewed as potential sources of contamination discovered by the MPCA. The city of Andover is supportive of the efforts of the MPCA to bring municipal water to the Red Oaks neighborhood, that is currently seeing contamination of the private wells. Please note our current city water supply has been tested, is clean, safe, and meets all MDH regulatory standards. For the past 9 months, our residents have been using bottled water, thankfully provided by the state, but I look forward to restoring their ability to fill a healthy glass of water from the tap once again, a simple effort many of us take for granted. And I thank you for your time and consideration.
Mr. Dickinson, are you presenting too, or are you here for questions?
I'm going to defer to Kirk Kadelka from the MPC at this time, and I'll wrap up if there's anything left. Otherwise, I'll be mute.
Commissioner Kadelka, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. This project is part of the governor's bonding bill. I just want to talk a little bit about how we got here. We've been expanding our monitoring of contaminants emerging concern, including 1,4-dioxane and PFAS at all of our closed landfills, in part due to increased funding from the legislature last legislative session. I'd like to thank you for that ability. So in May, we started sampling our routine program around the WDE landfill, and we added 5 homes to add more data points to the effort. And we found one of the homes exceeded the health-based value set by the Department of Health for 1,4-dioxane. So over the summer, and you can see on the map, we moved from the northeast where we were sampling to the south and to the west. And as we made that step out, we increasingly found more contamination at higher levels. In total, we found 50 private wells that exceeded the Department of Health's health-based values. We provided those homeowners with bottled water so they could have safe drinking water immediately. However, this is not a sustainable long-term solution. Connecting these homes to the city's drinking water system is a long-term solution for the residents. MPCA has put together a mitigation and monitoring plan that outlines the portions of the Red Oak neighborhood that would be connected to the city's drinking water system based on the area seeing contamination exceeding the Department of Health's health-based values. And you see here the lines, the blue lines on a map that represent that area. The project would include installing municipal water lines down various streets, installing connections from water lines to individual homes, and sealing private wells. The last items are not bondable, so the project is in need of a mix of funding. And then finally, areas that have not been connected to the drinking water system will be monitored in 2022 based on previous sample results. In fact, next week, a number of homes will be sampled and will be getting results back in about a month. Given the overall sampling results, MPCA is also continuing to investigate the likely source of the contamination. If responsible parties are found, MPCA will seek cost recovery from them and use those recovered dollars to pay off any bonds or reimburse costs allocated through the appropriation. Thank you, Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Commissioner. Seeing no questions, thank you, Representative Scott, for presenting your bill. Next on the agenda, House File 4554, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing House File 4554. This is a request for a hospital in the area of Monoman, Minnesota, in the city. I could talk a lot about it, but I think the best thing for me to do is go right to my testifier. I think he's got some information for you. So if you would, Mr. Dale Kruger, the hospital administrator.
Mr. Kruger, please identify yourself and proceed.
I'm Dale Kruger. I'm the CEO at Monoman Health Center. And I'd like to thank the chairman, the committee, and Representative Green for the opportunity to meet with you today. Monoman Health Center is owned by Monoman County and the city of Monoman with a joint powers agreement. And the project is for the replacement of a critical access hospital built in 1957 and the replacement of a nursing home built in 1969. The project is planned to be built on the same location, saving the cost of land acquisition and additional infrastructure costs. And once the new construction is completed, residents will move to their new home and patients will be transitioned to the new hospital and the current building will be demolished, creating additional green space and a parking lot. Monoman Health Center is 100% within the boundaries of White Earth Indian Reservation, and it's the only critical access hospital and nursing home on the White Earth Indian Reservation. Monoman County is the poorest county in Minnesota, and we're ranked 87 out of 87 in regards to health outcomes. 47% of the White Earth population is below poverty level, and 23% of Monoman County is below poverty level. We serve the BIPOC community as we're 53% racially diverse compared to Minnesota's average of about 17%. We have a 15% disabled population compared to Minnesota average of 11%. and 29% of Monoman County's land is tax exempt due to tribal trust and DNR status. And due to the high poverty level in our area, bad debts for Monoman Health Center is nearly $1 million a year, or about 10% compared to Minnesota hospitals average of about 2%. Our current building dates back to 1957 and is licensed for 18 beds. The nursing home is licensed for 32 beds. Our service area is the White Earth Reservation and the counties of Monoman, Norman, Becker, and Clearwater. And we are very remote. Detroit Lakes is 40 miles away, Crookston's 55, Bemidji 61, Fargo 70, and Grand Forks is 80 miles away. The hospital emergency room sees about 3,500 annual visits, incidents where the patients would not live to reach the next nearest hospital. In 2019, recognizing the inefficiencies of the current structure and the lack of conformity to ADA and life safety codes, the board hired an outside consultant to review and analyze the building. The highlights or lowlights of the building inefficiencies were the lack of ability to meet infection control and infection prevention standards, lack of fresh air returns, temperature control challenges. In our nursing home, we have one toilet for four nursing home residents. We don't have a sink in the nursing home toilet rooms. There's no negative airflow. Hallways are inadequate across the structure. We have no ADA restrooms for staff and visitors, and the current design just doesn't allow for safety and security, leaving our most vulnerable population at risk. We're at end of life for hot and cold water systems, the sewer systems, HVAC, electrical, ventilation, roofing, windows, lighting. Some of the roofing is actually was not engineered to carry the snow load, which is something that we just found out recently also. And we do have issues with lead in the incoming water sources. The board of directors hired the consultants Obernill Engineering out of Fargo to complete the assessment, and they conservatively estimated that it would cost between $8 and $10 million to get the building up to meet minimum standards, but that would leave us with an old building that would still not meet many of the ADA or life safety code challenges. And Obernill recommended that we replace or completely renovate the building. And so the board of directors hired JLG Architects. They were contracted in 2020 to start the process. On September 3rd, the state of Minnesota recognized the facility's shortcomings, the nursing home shortcomings, and a moratorium was accepted by the state of Minnesota, and it was one of four applications that was approved. And the current cost of the hospital and the nursing home project using the 2019 figures and 2020 figures is $32 million. And we are requesting $16 million from the state of Minnesota, and the remainder would be funded from operations. And you might ask, can the project be phased? Yes, it will be phased to provide least disruption for our residents and our patients.
Mr. Kruger, can I have you wrap up, please?
Sure. Yep. And like I said, there's actually not a set timeline for the hospital completion. However, because the building is all under one roof, relocating entrances, mechanical systems, and workflow, it's more practical to have the construction as one project. So I'll leave it to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kruger. And seeing no question, thank you, Representative Green, for coming by to present your proposal. Next on the agenda, House File 4367, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is really important to me. As a flight attendant, we are often one of the last lines of defense for human trafficking. Oftentimes, we're the last adults that they see before they may be lost forever. So it's such an honor to carry this bill today. Appropriating $150,000 for renovations for Brittany's Place. launched in 2014 as Minnesota's first and largest emergency shelter for youth survivors of sex trafficking. Today, Brittany's Place offers a full spectrum of services. All services are designed to meet the specific needs of youth at risk for or who have experienced sex trafficking and exploitation. Street outreach, training services for youth serving agencies, and parental counsel address prevention and intervention. Emergency shelter and a new transitional living program launched here in 2022 address housing needs. Case management services offered to clients and residents and to unsheltered clients in the community round out the care. Like I said, they are opening a new transitional living and shelter space, and this space will be trauma-informed, creating a building that has designed spaces for calming emotions and making sure clients are safe. The organization that runs Brittany's Place, 180 Degrees, has raised $400,000 privately and are asking for $150,000 to finish off the construction and capital investment. I'll turn the rest of my time over to my testifier, Mr. Farr.
Mr. Farr, welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Farr, P-F-A-R-R. I'm the CEO of 180 Degrees. I would just like to say that Brittany's Place is a statewide asset. We get girls from all over the state. Reminder that they are under the age of 18 when they come to us, often in crisis. The last few weeks, we have had girls dropped off by the St. Paul Police, the FBI, Dakota County Sheriff's Office, bringing girls to our doors at 2 a.m., 3 in the morning, weekends, 7 days a week, holidays. This is how we operate. We have decided that the rehab of this building, the intent is to soften the interior to reflect a home-like atmosphere for the girls, also called well design, which use 7 categories of wellness. And this allows us to better treat the trauma that the girls come in with. We would have 5 shelter beds, 8 transitional living beds, and it's also built to handle more of our community outreach and other services that we have. We are the largest shelter and transitional living combination for SEY girls, sexually exploited girls, in the state of Minnesota. It's a statewide asset. As was said by Representative Berg, we have raised approximately $400,000, and we are looking for $150,000 to finish the project. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farr, and thank you, Representative Berg. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to the next bill of the agenda. And so the next bill of the agenda will be my House File 4674, and so I'll turn it over to Chair Murphy.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your bill presentation.
Thank you, Chair Murphy, and thank you, committee. So before us is the House File 4674, and I do have the DE amendment that I want to walk members through. And just so all of you know, this is laying the foundation for some of the content that will be in the bill that Representative Jordan is going to talk about later on after this one. And so this bill is looking at the lead service line appropriations that we, the state of Minnesota, have received from the federal government. And in section 1 of the bill, the DE requires the Commissioner of Health to create an intended use plan for the funding the appropriation for lead service line. And then that we go on to require the Department of Health, you know, to require the information that is included in there when applicants are applying for this. This is paragraph B of section 1. And then we go on to define what is a disadvantaged community. It means a census tract in whole or in part where at least 3 of the following criteria apply. In there, we have the metrics of 20% or more residents have income below the federal poverty threshold, which is 26,246. We have another metric, the social vulnerability index greater than 0.080. This is a measure or a tool for public health officials and emergency response planners to help them identify communities that will need additional support during and after a public health emergency and plan for the provision of services to those communities. We also have a metric about the upper limit of the lowest quintile of household income that is less than the state upper limit of the lowest quintile. This is $32,201. We also have a metric looking at housing vacancy rate greater than the state average, which is 10.2%. And then the last metric that we have in there is the percent of population receiving SNAP benefits, which is greater than the state average of 7.5%. And members, just so you know where these metrics are coming from, you know, and looking at the federal government's guidance on the implementation of the bipartisan infrastructure law, these are some of the metrics that they suggest they use when we look at defining disadvantaged communities or affordability. And I believe attached to the email that Ms. Nash, the community administrator, have sent out, we do include these maps for your reference so you can see, you know, if any of these, you know, criteria, you know, three of them have to be met in order to be considered a disadvantaged community in my proposal. And then I think to the main discussion of my proposal, section two, just so members know, according to the federal bipartisan infrastructure law, Minnesota is standing to get $43 million, $161,000 for lead service line replacement. And so what I'm proposing here is that of the 49% of the funds, which equates to just less than $21.2 million, that $21.2 million has to be used for principal forgiveness or for grants. And so what I'm proposing here is that we use the funding, the appropriations for principal forgiveness or for grants for private lead service line replacement. I know that Representative Jordan has that in her proposal later on too. And we also have language in there that, you know, in any year by September 30th, if there's not enough applicants for the private lead service line replacement, the funding can go back to being used for the other activities as allowed by the federal government. And then in talking to the EPA, they have said that, you know, we could use 10% of the principal forgiveness or grant money for technical set-asides. And so that's what I'm proposing here, to set aside 10% of the money, which totals about $2.1 million to do the following activity: planning and designing for lead service line infrastructure projects, developing or updating lead service line inventories, including locating and mapping lead service lines, providing technical assistance to small water systems undertaking lead service line inventories or construction projects, non-routine and lead sampling conducted for reasons other than mandatory compliance with an ordinance, law, or rule, or to fund state staff and contractors to work on lead service line education and outreach, inventory, and other associated activities. And then in addition to that, when I was talking to the federal EPA, they had said that for funding for lead service line inventory, you could look at any of the funds coming in for the drinking water state revolving fund, whether that's through the regular formula, through the supplemental funding that's coming in from the bipartisan infrastructure law, or through the lead service line funding. And so that's why we have the language in there requiring that 10% of all those funds coming into the state must be used for lead service line inventory. This is to help out all the water system in our state. And we also have a similar language that I have before, that if there are not enough requests for the dedicated amount by September 30th, the money can be used for the other lead service line replacement activities or the other activities that the funding has been allocated for. And then we also require a report for the disbursement of these funds. And then section three is additional appropriations, geo bonds for publicly owned portions of drinking water lead service line. And then general fund appropriations to the Department of Health to help develop and update lead service line inventories. And that's the DE amendment, Madam Chair. And I understand that we do have Mr. Freeman here to provide testimony from the PFA.
Because the PFA would be administering the DE3. Is that correct?
So, you know, so the funding will go to the PFA, and then, you know, for any of the work that needs to be done through the Department of Health, they will have to coordinate with the Department of Health currently, like what they are doing right now.
Okay. Representative Erdahl, do you have a question at this time, or do you want to wait for Director Freeman's
I can
before
wait
that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, I can wait till Director Freeman is done.
Okay. So, Director Freeman, will you identify yourself and tell us what you think about DE3?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. We all agree that drinking water lead service lines are a major public health risk and need to be replaced as soon as possible. Helping cities do lead line inventories, getting their projects through the application and funding process, and then actually doing the construction work are all essential activities to achieve the goal. The federal infrastructure funds offer a tremendous opportunity to jumpstart this work. As we've learned more from the EPA guidance, we know there are ways those funds can be used for inventories, for project planning and design, and for, of course, the actual construction. As mentioned, the federal funds are split between grants and loans, which we think will make it possible for the work to be done at no cost to home or property owners. But there are still a number of issues and variables that we need to better understand. Not all cities are in the same place in conducting their inventories. Some have largely completed that work. Others haven't yet started. We also know that the percentage of private versus public ownership of service line varies significantly between cities, and that both parts must be replaced at the same time. The PFA and Health Department have been working for months to understand the federal funding and to learn from our cities their needs, their plans, and their concerns. To effectively and efficiently do this work, we need flexibility. This bill would go in the opposite direction, imposing requirements and restrictions that will make it more difficult to accomplish the goal of removing all lead lines. I do not support this bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, appreciate the feedback from Director Freeman. And I would disagree that this is actually putting additional barriers to cities and water systems that is actually trying to do this work. What we're doing here is that we're setting aside money coming in from the feds to be used for lead service line inventory. And then in Representative Jordan's bill and her proposal, there's a request in there to set aside some funding, 70% of any state funding or federal funding to use for private lead service line. And so what we're trying to do here is to allow for the grants and the principal forgiveness to be used for private lead service line. And I want to give you an example, Madam Chair and members, that in my city, if we were to look at, you know, some of the maps that have been given to all of you and look at the index or the metric of federal poverty guidelines, more, you know, majority of my district, you know, most of those folks live below the federal poverty guideline of $26,000. And from what we have heard from the city of Minneapolis, where lead service line replacement could cost between $5,000 to $7,000, you think about that, you know, you're expecting a family who's making $26,000 to spend a fifth of their income to replace lead service line. And so I think that, you know, this is why, you know, we need to make sure that we allow for, you know, the grants and the principal forgiveness dollars in the proposal to help pay for lead service line for everyone in the state who needs it the most. And so that's the proposal before us, Madam Chair. And, you know, I welcome the opportunity to continue to engage with the PFA and other members who are interested in this and see what can we do to make sure that we actually take out the lead service line in all communities across the state.
Thank you. Director Freeman, do you have a rebuttal?
Madam Chair, thanks. I don't. This is complicated by the fact that each city is different in terms of the ownership issue, and where they're at in the overall process. And I don't see that these requirements are helpful. I believe we need flexibility so that we can use the available funds efficiently, effectively, get the work done as cost effectively as possible. And I absolutely agree that we want to use the principal forgiveness grant funds to ensure that the work is done at no cost to property owners. I absolutely agree with that.
Thank you very much. I think Representative Erdahl, now we're ready for your question.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think that we need to seriously consider the concerns referenced by Director Freeman. You know, he has a lot of experience in this area, and I would hope that the committee chair and others work with him to resolve some of his concerns. Concern that I have, and you know, maybe it's not valid, but it you know is a concern to me that the criteria is so specific that it may exclude parts of the state. And so I'd like some comment, I guess, from Chair Lee or Director Freeman, if that is the case. Greater Minnesota, all of Minnesota needs to be concerned about lead in the pipes. And I want to make sure that the whole state is addressed with this.
Okay, thank you, Representative Erdahl. And I will ask for further discussion on this bill or on this amendment. But I also would like to remind the members of the committee that the next bill and the bill after that also have to do with some things that go along with this. So let us not make our conclusions too early. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Erdahl. I do share that concern too, and that's why, you know, in the definition that we have here for disadvantaged community, we're requiring that at least three of the following be used as a metric of determining, you know, what is a disadvantaged community. And, you know, like I have mentioned in the packet that Ms. Nash has sent out, we have maps in there. And so you could go and take a look at the maps and look at the different metrics of how we are measuring the ability for the ratepayer, the homeowners, the taxpayer, the Minnesotans, and their ability to pay for this replacement work. And I know that we're going to have more in-depth conversation on this, like Chair Murphy said, on some of the later bills too. And so what I want members to take away from this is to really consider the impact to the ratepayers, the taxpayers, the Minnesotans, you know, and not, you know, necessarily where they actually live in the state, but actually the impact to the individual taxpayer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Abaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee, for bringing this forward. I guess I just have a clarifying question maybe of Mr. Freeman. What is, and I don't know if you said it in your original statement, but what is the current metric that you're using now to determine, you know, the schedule of replacing these lead lines across the state?
Director Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative, the process is that cities apply, starting with the health department, when they have actual projects ready to proceed, and they get on the project priority list, and we then bring them through the funding application process. At this point, I don't know how many projects and the pace of the projects that will be coming forward. But as they do, we'll see those this summer and prepare our funding list this fall. With $43 million per year available, I anticipate we will be funding all of the eligible projects that come forward. And we will work with each city to ensure that the grant portion of the funding can be used to make sure that the cost to the property owner is zero, that there's no cost to the property owner. I think that's feasible to do based on the current, what we know about the current volume and pace of projects. Certainly this will be an activity that continues on at least for the next 5 years with the federal funds and likely well for another 5 years beyond that. I believe the goal in Representative Jordan's bill is 10 years to do it all. At this point, I think the funding is sufficient, and we should make sure the funding is sufficient to provide that funding to all of the homeowners, all of the property owners in the state that have lead service lines, so that nobody has to pay the cost. To have extra criteria saying some people can get grants and some people can't, I think just makes the process more difficult and to achieve the ultimate goal.
Representative Abadje.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Director Freeman, for that. I guess my question really then kind of comes to, because we know that there are some areas in the state that, you know, this is a larger issue for them more than others. And so, I think part of this amendment is trying to do is making sure that we're hitting some of those groups sooner. And so I guess I'm just kind of wondering, like, what is the metric then that you're currently using for prioritization? And so I'm just wondering if that metric, which I think maybe in a previous presentation may have been around median income, and just kind of wondering how that metric has been used before and what are the results that you're seeing with that?
Madam Chair, Representative,
so the health department is currently working on their amendments to their project priority rules that will rank all lead service line replacement projects at a higher ranking. These projects will move right to the top of the list from all cities. Within that list, I think projects are ranked in order or reverse order of meeting household income. But again, my goal would be to fund all of the projects. If a city has a project ready to go, I think our goal should be to get funding for that city and to do that project. And if we get into this and we realize at some point there are more projects than the federal funding and any other funding available, then we certainly will come back to the legislature to talk about that and find out how we can get more resources.
Director Freeman, have you seen the maps that Representative Lee was talking about?
Madam Chair, I did take a quick look at them. I don't know if there's something wrong with my computer, but I don't see the color coding on them as well. But I'm concerned that if every city in the state, we have to determine, do they meet three of the five criteria here? It will spend a lot of time trying to decipher who's in and who's out, and that will take time and resources away from actually getting the projects done.
All right. Thank you for that. Representative Agbaje.
Yep, last comment. Thank you very much for that, Director Freeman. I guess I would just kind of say towards that this amendment looks like it's being a priority list. So it's not necessarily so much choosing who does and who doesn't, just kind of, I think, restructuring the timeframe. And I agree with you. I think every city in the state should have their projects funded. But one of the things I would like to press upon, which is why I support this amendment, is the idea that, you know, we can figure out a priority listing that supports many of our most vulnerable communities. I think this priority listing of three out of five that is hopefully not as onerous as it sounds, but you know, it's using a lot of metrics that are already in play for a lot of programs that we already have across the state. And so I would just continue to encourage the conversations to ensure that we are, you know, really prioritizing the communities around the state that are in dire need of this. I think one thing with, you know, the reverse area median income that you said is depending on the area that you're using, which I'm not entirely clear, but if you are using like a city or a county, sometimes the more vulnerable places within that area don't get picked up right away. So I would just encourage more conversation to make sure that we're getting to a point where we can create a priority list that effectively gets us to all of the areas that need this help in a timely manner. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Moran.
Madam Chair and members, I guess I heard the answer to my question, but I have maybe two for Director Freeman. I'm still not too sure what makes a project eligible. So, and you don't have to take you can maybe send me something that shows me what makes a project eligible. That I think that would be helpful. And if you can also send me a list of projects over maybe the last 5 years that has been made a priority, I think that would be helpful, you know, because you're right, this needs to be a statewide initiative, but it also needs to be, and hopefully we'll see that the fairness and equitable process that was taken to make sure that we're reaching those most vulnerable families that need the support from us. So those two things, if Director Freeman can do that, that would be awesome.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Director Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, in terms of the first question, eligibility, every city that has lead service lines within its drinking water system is eligible for these federal funds, eligible to apply to the health department's priority list and receive funding. I can send you what the current priority list looks like. However, it does not take into account the health department's new rules on that prioritize the lead service lines at a higher level. It also does not include all of the new projects, the new cities that have come forward now with the new federal money being available. So that list will look significantly different this summer when the health department finalizes their 2023 priority list.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's interesting to me the discussion on the criteria having resistance to that, to changes there. I think it's important to note that the legislature can establish criteria. And the difference is, we have an amazing state demographer. The maps that are posted on the committee website, I think were generated in about an hour. They're at our fingertips. We have a state demographer whose job it is to provide demographic information. And we can identify areas in census tracts that have greater poverty, greater challenges than others. So if you apply a medium household income across the city of, let's just say, St. Paul, there are areas that may have greater poverty than others. And it seems what Representative Terry Lee is doing is saying we should prioritize with that criteria, those census tracts that need the help the most first. Those that need the help the most first. And we can do that with data. And we could do that with the applications where when a city applies, they can identify the census tract and they could say, does that census tract meet 3 of the 5 criteria? The idea that we're still 30 years ago where we have to double check and look it up is frankly ludicrous. We have the data at our fingertips right now, and we can use the census tracts throughout the state. And it appears the 5 criteria that are referenced have census tracts all over the state that need assistance. So if there is enough money, we do the worst first. And then we go to the next, and it's triaging and working at the worst first to try to help those folks first. So I applaud your work here, Charlie. I think it is a legitimate use, and we do have this information. All Minnesotans have this information at their fingertips.
Thank you, Representative Hansen, and thank you, Charlie and Director Freeman. We are 10 minutes over 11 minutes behind in time for this because I let you go. And I probably shouldn't have allowed that much time, but maybe we can get a little bit more less time off of the next bill that's coming up. And I will now turn the virtual gavel back to you, Representative Lee, unless you have a concluding remark that you'd like to make under my gavel.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Just a quick comment, and then I do see Representative Lucero. And so I don't know, Representative Lucero, if you could wait for Representative Jordan, too, or if you want to make your comments, question on this bill.
I can wait.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Lucero. And so, Chair Murphy, just quick comments to the point about, you know, the funding available. That's why we had in Section 3 additional appropriations for less service line replacement. And so, you know, if we are proposing to do and move forward with what I'm proposing here, where we use the grant and the principal forgiveness for the private lead service line, we still have the ability, you know, like Director Freeman said, from the state to put in additional appropriations to address and meet that need that, you know, have been taken away from the federal funds too. And so we have the flexibility here. It takes the effort of the committee and the will of the legislature to make that happen. And so I'm not concerned with, you know, the funding that's necessary, that's needed. We have a proposal in place that could make up that need with additional funding, Madam Chair.
Very good. You have the gavel, Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next on the agenda, we have Representative Jordan, House File 4115. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll try to go quickly, but I'm excited to present House File 4115 to you this morning, which is a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead in their drinking water through lead service lines. As you all know, this is a very important issue that, and I presented in this committee before. And so this bill, I'm sure you all remember when I presented House File 2650. And so this bill, 4115, has incorporated the feedback I received from you and from various committees that I presented that bill in. It also incorporates ideas from other levels of government and our state agencies and input from clean water advocates across the state. As we just discussed, lead exposure through drinking water is a statewide issue. Lead service lines are present across Minnesota in all communities, and no amount of exposure to lead is safe. Here's specifically what this bill does. It creates a state grant program for lead line removal administered by the Department of Health, funded at $30 million a year for 10 years. Municipalities and community water systems are eligible for grants to remove and replace lead service lines, and the money can be used to repay loans for the same purposes. It prioritizes cities' water system that have a plan to remove all lead lines and have identified how they will maximize participation from homeowners. Large systems, so Minneapolis and St. Paul specifically, must also develop a workforce plan to promote and expand the use of apprentices and those underrepresented in the construction industry. It creates a separate grant program funded at $10 million to provide support for municipalities in producing an inventory and mapping the location of lead lines. The EPA did recently finalize an update to the lead and copper rule, which requires water systems to produce an inventory by October 2024 and have a plan to remove those lead lines. So this bill would require the inventory and plan to be submitted to MDH, and it also requires water systems to notify MDH when lead levels in their water exceeds 10 micrograms per liter and explain how they will comply with federal requirements to lower the accepted lead use. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have a number of testifiers who can talk more about how the bill would affect them, and I'd like to turn over my time to them. And I can take more questions too. I know that was a pretty abbreviated version of this.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Jordan. So we're going to go to public testifier first and then Representative Lucero. So first on the agenda, Mr. Thorson, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. My name is John Thorson. I'm legislative director for LIUNA, Minnesota and North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union, representing more than 13,000 skilled construction laborers who build and maintain our roads, highways, bridges, and the basic utilities that allow our communities to thrive. We're proud to stand with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, Conservation Minnesota, the Operating Engineers Local 49, and the Associated General Contractors in seeking a transformational investment in our state's future that'll put us on a path for removing the estimated 100,000 to 260,000 lead lines that threaten our drinking water today. We strongly support provisions of House File 4115, the call for eliminating all lead service lines in our state by 2032, and provide the direct grant funding necessary to ensure that cities can map, identify, and replace both the lead pipes in the public right-of-way and the approximated 70% of service lines that are on private property. We know the need is large. We know there's also a hard deadline to map and develop an inventory of October 16th, 2024 that needs to be met by all cities. It was mentioned in testimony to the previous bill. Cities are all over the place and where they are in either beginning, completing, or needing to do this. We also know this is an issue that affects every corner of the state. We know it's a complicated issue. Our coalition has been meeting regularly since this fall and been in a lot of dialogue with the PFA, the Department of Health, the Governor's Office, nonprofits like Rural Water, the League of Cities, other environmental groups and public health groups, and individual cities and how they're approaching this. We've also looked at other communities across the country, like Denver, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Newark, New Jersey, and again, cities here like St. Paul, St. Cloud, and others. This is, again, a complicated issue. I believe this is the seventh hearing that this bill has received. It's something that's gone through Chair Freiberg's, Hansen's, Liebling's, Pawlowski's, and your committee, Mr. Chair. We're working hard to get this done right. We are looking forward to the jobs that are created. It's estimated that about 2,400 jobs per year will be created and maintained through the replacement of lead lines in both the public and private lines, and that I want to thank Representative Jordan for bringing this proposal forward, urge the members of the committee to support House File 4115, these critical investments, get these lead lines replaced. We believe it can be done in the next 10 years, and that clean drinking water can be delivered to families and children across the state, increase the health, social, and economic vitality of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thorson. Next on the agenda, Mr. Morse, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Lee and members of the committee. My name is Steve Morse. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, state's largest coalition of environmental and conservation groups. And we're super excited to be here today and really appreciate the time you, Chair Lee, and the committee have invested in looking at this issue and moving forward on this issue. We think it's long overdue. We especially appreciate the work of Representative Jordan, as well as the Department of Health and the PFA in thinking through some of these issues. It is complicated, as we've heard. Representative Jordan started, we had the pleasure of starting to work with her last year on this proposal. I've been working with her since then. And we're really happy to see after this initial state engagement, now the federal government has stepped up with funding and it's really accelerated the interest and made it a real imperative for the state to act. From the MEP community perspective, we've seen this as a priority for some time. Over the last couple of years, we started doing testing in communities in Duluth, and we appreciate the definition of disadvantaged communities that you have in your previous bill, Representative Lee, because we worked with community groups and went into some of those areas in West Duluth. And what we found is we tested 52 homes in that area working with community leaders, and we found that 19% of them had water coming out of their taps in the morning that was above that threshold, that EPA threshold that Representative Jordan was just referencing. We find that unacceptable, and we think that everyone needs to have a right to safe and clean and affordable drinking water. as a coalition, we believe it's important because we work to keep our water safe and drinkable, whether they're in the lake or in the river, but we also want it to be safe and drinkable and healthy when it comes out of the tap for people to drink. So we think there are three really important factors or critical considerations in this bill that we support and in the overall effort. The first would be the 100% replacement, and there seems to be a consensus that that's what we need to do, replace all of the pipelines. The second is the 10-year timeframe. We think it's really important to set a horizon on this because we know it is a public health, and as Representative Jordan said, there is no safe drinking water, there is no safe level. And we also think it has to be done at no cost to homeowners statewide in order to make it done and doable in this time frame. And it seems like there's a general consensus to move in that direction, and we greatly appreciate it. Lastly, I would just add, Representative Lee, I appreciate your consideration of this and thinking creatively and how to fund it. We know it's more difficult because we cannot just bond for it. It's going to take general fund dollars and other mechanisms. And so we appreciate your support to move this forward because it is a critical public health issue, especially for those communities that have historically been disadvantaged and lower income where more of this lead pipeline is lead pipelines are still in use. Thank you. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Next up, we have Mayor Cooley from Worthington. Mayor, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee. My name is Mike Cooley. I'm the mayor of Worthington, Minnesota, and a board member of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We advocate for more than 110 cities around the state, outside the county, seven county metro. And I am testifying in favor of House File 4115. Cities are front and center when it comes to providing clean drinking water. We all know, it's been said many times this morning, that lead in drinking water is a serious health concern. Between now and October 2024, my city and cities across state will be performing an inventory of the lead service lines in our water systems as required by the federal lead and copper rule. As with many cities in outstate, we will have to create a plan to then address and remove the lead piping. Worthington has begun working on this issue, but performing this inventory will be very time intensive. And it will be even more challenging for smaller cities in Minnesota because they do not have the resources to perform this work. The Adrians, the Bigelows, the Brewsters, they don't have the records. They don't have the staff. And to verify, it's going to be a hiring contractors that will cost a lot of money. That is why we support creating a grant program to help cities perform the inventory and to prepare a plan for responding to what we find. We don't know what that inventory will show, but we do know that many Minnesota cities have housing stock that was built before the 1940s and may have lead pipes or fixtures. Worthington, as many of you know, is the most diverse city in the state of Minnesota. We have a significant number of immigrants in our community with 12 different cultures that tend to live in the older and cheaper housing stock. So I applaud what Chairman Lee is trying to do with the amendment and trying to be equitable and helping. Income and language barriers will be challenging for us to fix this issue. These homeowners that need to replace the lines may be the least likely to be able to afford it. Private side funding is very important because in our city, the water line from the curb to the house is private. And then you go inside the house. So we appreciate that the federal infrastructure bill is providing Minnesota money to help pay for lead pipe replacement. But that appropriation requires a 50% loan for the cost of replacement. We support House File 4115 and many of the amendments that are being considered because it will provide more grant money to make replacement more affordable for our cities and homeowners. Cities are under enormous pressure with not only this drinking water issue, but on the wastewater side with the PFAS and chloride monitoring. While this bill provides funding, some mandates are a real issue at this level of government. We think that the lead pipe issue needs to be addressed across the state, both in the metro and greater Minnesota. We support bills such as this one that take an important step forward in lead line replacement. And from snowy Worthington, Minnesota, I say thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Cooley. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've had the opportunity just to briefly review the five criteria. And so I have a couple questions or comments regarding that. So the first is, when I read them, can you confirm my understanding in regards to the criteria that they are predominantly income-based or threshold-type-based, but that the income or poverty level or SNAP benefits, et cetera, doesn't necessarily apply to the owner of the property. It would apply to the tenants. Is my understanding correct? If in the case of a rental.
Representative Lucero, so that definition may apply to folks who have been identified under the U.S. Census Bureau as fitting those criteria, regardless of if they're a homeowner or renter.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, I just have my recollection is the city of St. Paul, for example. I think 40% of St. Paul is rental, if I'm correct, and I stand to be corrected if I'm wrong. I don't know what the percentage is for Minneapolis, but the criteria then in this particular case would apply to the resident of the home, not to the homeowner, and therefore there's a disconnect if the argument is being made that the homeowner doesn't have the ability to pay. Well, there's a disconnect there in the formula, in the criteria being used of who's actually would pay for such replacement. Number two, I have a great concern, has already been highlighted, of other parts of the state. I think that the criteria here is going to focus much of the money closer to the metro area, leaving much of the rest of the state of Minnesota. Third, according to the criteria, I didn't see any part of the criteria of being concentration levels or threat. Now, I am by no means a lead expert in any capacity, but I suspect, and I'm also stand to be corrected, that there are variable degrees of concern of deterioration, for example, of lead pipe. And because of some circumstances, there might be a higher concentration of lead in some areas versus others due to the age of the infrastructure. And I don't see that criteria in there. So there could be some community that has a higher concentration of lead that gets pushed to the bottom of the priority list simply because they don't are not at poverty. And then one more comment I would make is poverty isn't the only criteria by which someone would pay, whether they are the homeowner or not. There are many families that are not at the level of poverty, but have other circumstances in their life that prevent them the ability to pay. And there's a whole host of circumstances by which people are not at poverty, but are struggling to pay. And so, again, I think this criteria is not the direction we should go. It adds complexity, and I think it ignores the fact that lead is a threat to everybody in Minnesota, not just those that are below poverty. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that, Representative Lucero. And I would say that, you know, according to the Clean Water Act right now in federal law, we have to consider affordability criteria. And then this is also used as a guidance for the affordability around income, unemployment data, population trends, and other data determined by the state. Mm-hmm. And so what we're looking here is that, you know, we're not asking about if you're a renter or a homeowner. We're looking at if you're a resident in that area and if you have lead, you know, service line. What we're proposing here is to use the federal funding to come in there and help out those that are most needy to take out the lead. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to make it clear that, you know, we're not proposing anything. If you look at the packet that I have sent all of you from Ms. Nash, from the EPA guidance on how to implement the federal funds that's coming, on page 41 and 42, they actually talk about these are the criteria that you can consider. And so this is a proposal that, you know, myself, Representative Jordan, we are proposing for. If you have any, you know, additional comments and you have a different path for looking at how do we, make sure that we address people with the most need. You know, we still have the ability to, you know, have that conversation on what can we do to make sure that we hit the people and cover the people who needs the help the most. And so, you know, appreciate the feedback that you have brought forth, and, you know, look at the guidance. And if you have any additional feedback, let us know. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lucero, I think, brought forth some of concerns that we have. And you know, I'm willing, and I'm sure he is as well, that we are willing to work with you to address if there is validity to these concerns, to make sure that they are rectified, because this certainly is an important issue. But we want to make sure that the whole state is covered and those who really are in need get addressed. That said, I have a question of Mr. Thorson. He mentioned that there are 100,000 lines. Now, are those lines measured in feet or miles, or what is the total term that we should use to describe how much needs to be addressed?
Mr. Thorson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, believe there is between 100,000, it's estimated between 100,000 and 260,000 lead lines. And those numbers come from, I believe, a U of M MDH study. And it's the number of lines into residences. So it's not in feet or length, it's the lines and hookups themselves.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Mr. Thorson. So I'm basically, I mean, for the most part, we're talking about lines running from the street to the dwellings. Is that what this would be then? 100,000 of those?
Mr. Thorson.
Correct. From the water main into the residence.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, Representative Jordan, any quick closing comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you again to this committee for all the time and interest in addressing our lead service line issue. One other thing I did want to mention is that we do, we being the state, additionally the city of Minneapolis and Ramsey County do this, where they actually monitor with infants and small children, there are lead levels are monitored. And when a child is found to have an elevated blood level, which is currently set at 5 micrograms per deciliter, that is taken into effect, and members from MDH, the city of Minneapolis, or Ramsey County come in and do assist those families currently. And that would not, so that is one way that we are already prioritizing people who are found to have an elevated blood level. So that is being taken into consideration when we're thinking about how, and this is a question that is complicated and I appreciate all the feedback, is we do need to think about how we're going to prioritize these lead lines. And doing that additional testing would also create barriers if we were going to test the water. But there is currently a, for lack of a better word, surveillance system in place to identify elevated blood levels in the most vulnerable, which is very small children. Again, I want to thank the committee for all of your time. Chair Lee, I want to thank you for all the work you've also done addressing lead lines. And I want to thank you for your consideration this morning.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Next on the agenda, House File 4736, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 4736 relates to climate resiliency and reduction of greenhouse gases. And members, you may remember as we toured throughout the state, stopping at various wastewater treatment facilities, I and others often asked about solar installations, energy efficiency measures, things that were being proposed when there was going to be wastewater upgrades. If you look at the bill on lines 1.14 and 1.15, it adds the criteria for climate resiliency and greenhouse gas emissions. Mr. Chair, I think you have posted a large document dated March 8th, 2022, implementation of the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Fund provisions of the bipartisan infrastructure law. Members, I would encourage you to look on page 5 of 56 at the bottom, support climate adaptation. EPA strongly encourages states to support water, wastewater, stormwater infrastructure projects that apply the best available and most geographically relevant climate information projections and standards, and drive towards energy efficient and climate smart water systems. Wastewater, water, and water systems are significant energy users and release potent greenhouse gases, including nitrous oxide and methane. EPA strongly encourages states to use BIL funding to support local water and wastewater agencies' efforts to reduce nitrous oxide and methane emissions. That is why the bill is here. There is an amendment that was adopted in the Environment Finance Committee, the A2 amendment, that includes the same criteria, 3 out of 5, that Chair Lee referenced. It also has an appropriation, Section 6, the lead service line replacement, some definitions, and then an appropriation to the Met Council. I'm not asking that portion, Section 6, be considered in the bonding bill, but that it is going to be included in the Omnibus Environment Finance Bill, because the Metropolitan Council water systems are within the jurisdiction of that committee. That is the bill and the amendment that should be adopted when we have when the first engrossment is in your possession.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. First, we're testimony, Mr. Johnson for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 4736. MPCA certainly shares the goal of encouraging a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and incorporating climate resiliency in wastewater and stormwater infrastructure. And we would say there are some projects on the project priority list that we see as great examples of resiliency projects, such as those that address infiltration and inflow, which can lead to discharge of untreated wastewater during wet weather years. We are seeing an increase in these situations, and adding that kind of criteria are related to providing additional points for such proposals for climate resiliency in that way could definitely help ensure these projects rank as a high priority. Unfortunately, we have consulted with our legal team, and the bill language suggests that our considerations suggest that we can't add a criterion related to ranking projects based on their ability to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The purpose of the Clean Water State Revolving Fund is to provide loans for wastewater and stormwater projects that support the goals of the Clean Water Act. So certainly there could be a criterion added that support climate resiliency as a whole as it relates to water quality. But we do see that the Clean Water Act doesn't include any greenhouse gas emission reduction goals, and therefore the proposed criterion would not be authorized under the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and can't be incorporated into our ranking of projects for the project priority list. We certainly appreciate the objective of the legislation. We find it important, and the opportunities to advance community goals for addressing climate and greenhouse gas concerns. We look forward to working with the author on this. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to provide testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Next up, Director Friedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. My concerns with the bill go to the A2 amendment. To be clear, the A2 amendment does not change priority criteria. It changes the criteria that are used for the WIF grant program. The purpose of the WIF grant program is to help cities repair and replace aging water infrastructure that would otherwise be unaffordable.
There are hundreds of cities on the priority list that need these funds to replace old treatment plants, both wastewater and drinking water treatment plants, pipes, and all the other manner of infrastructure components. The WIF program currently measures affordability by comparing the average system cost per household to the median household income of the community. The A2 amendment would throw out this per household affordability criteria and replace it with the broader demographic measures that were discussed earlier. I believe this would result in much less effective targeting of WIF grant funds to the cities that most need it. The reason that it's important to look at the per household cost for determining eligibility for WIF grants is that city water utilities operate as enterprise funds, which collect rates, revenues in the form of user rates, and then use those revenues to operate and maintain the system and make necessary capital improvements. Cities generally pay for these projects or primarily through user charges, whether they use those revenues directly or to pay debt service on loan funding. And those rates are charged proportionately to all users of the system under current state law. And similarly, if you provide a grant to help reduce the cost of a project, the benefits of that grant are shared by all users. Grant assistance to larger cities is diluted by their larger user base. Of course, virtually all cities have residents in poverty that face difficulty in paying water bills and many other costs. But I am not aware of any city in Minnesota that has a rate structure that would direct the benefits of WIF grant assistance to specifically to lower income residents. The benefit is spread across the entire community user base. That's why WIF grants tend to go to smaller cities that have a smaller number of users to share the costs. Even with WIF grants, the average residential cost for wastewater service in smaller cities is typically $50 to $60 a month or more, compared to an average of $29 a month for a household in the metro area. Without these grants, many small communities simply could not make the critical water infrastructure system improvements that they need. If costs are assessed to a smaller user base in some cases, we calculate WIF grants based on that smaller user base. And I think that also applies to the drinking water service projects that we're talking about in the future. We want to look at the cost impact to the household. We're looking at that methodology, and we'll be talking with EPA about how to adapt the current criteria to those lead service line projects. But the WIF program covers a broad manner of waste of water infrastructure, and it's really focused on the old treatment plants, the old pipes that many cities are struggling with. I believe the A2 amendment would seriously hurt the cities that most need it to maintain their basic water infrastructure systems. I do not support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Next on the agenda is Ms. Wafel. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Wafel, and I'm a senior attorney lobbyist with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We have more than 110 members who play an important role in protecting Minnesota's waters through our drinking water, stormwater, and wastewater systems. The importance of protecting our waters is something that all Minnesotans can agree on, whether urban or rural, Democrat or Republican. For the last several decades, the state of Minnesota has been a nationwide leader in ensuring that Minnesotans have clean water to drink, to fish in, and to recreate. The Water Infrastructure Fund has played an essential role in ensuring that the construction and upgrades needed for wastewater and drinking water systems are affordable for everyone, regardless of where they live. We are, as currently structured, the program, as Mr. Freeman described, pays grants to cities for infrastructure in situations where the construction costs would make the water and sewer bills so expensive that the residents could not afford it. We have significant concerns about the proposed changes to the WIF criteria for many of the reasons outlined by Mr. Freeman. It's not entirely clear to us who will benefit under these changes, but it does appear that many of our poorer cities in Greater Minnesota and in the metro area would no longer be eligible for these grants. This pushes cities into a terrible situation where they have to choose between complying with state and federal laws to keep their water systems, you know, operating, or that they will be raising their rates so high that residents on lower fixed incomes will face the choice of paying water bills and buying food, medicine, other things they need. We don't think that's an outcome that anyone wants. We understand that there is a strong desire to help residents in disadvantaged communities, but as, again, Mr. Freeman probably did a better job explaining this than I could, the WIF program, you know, isn't designed to benefit neighbors. Neighborhoods. It benefits the entire system. And you look at the Metropolitan Council and you have poor neighborhoods in Minneapolis also being served by, you know, along with some of the richest cities in the state. And the grant covers such a large surface area, it's not going to have a, you know, it's going to have a negligible impact, if any, on your disadvantaged residents. To help those residents, you know, there are things you can be doing, but making these changes to WIF really isn't going to help them, but it is going to hurt the communities it's currently serving. We want all Minnesotans to be able to have clean water and to be able to afford that clean water. And we look forward to working with, you know, leaders to try and make sure that that happens and continues to happen for all of us. Therefore, at least with respect to those changes, we also oppose it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wafo. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and thank you to the testifiers. My comments are originating out of the League of Minnesota Cities letter that Craig Johnson provided, and I know he's not here, but I'm hearing them echoed in Director Johnson, Freeman, and Ms. Wafel. So here's the thing. We are looking at a program that distributes resources based on a median. We recognize that medians have broad distributions of information, of people who are at the poorer end and the richer end. I think that we also recognize that looking at the maps that were distributed, that poverty is a statewide phenomenon. If we would doubt that, we would have heard, anyone who was on the 14-day bonding tour heard over and over about the pockets of poverty and the need in Minnesota cities across the state from north to south, east to west. I would really wonder if there has been actual modeling done of the impact of distributing these according to a different approach, because I'm hearing sweeping statements about this would cause hardship, this would cause, wouldn't have benefits, but I would really like to see data around that, because I think what we do know is that right now we have a regressive system where people who are well off are paying a much smaller share of their income and people who are poor are paying a greater share regardless of where they live. So my question is, maybe for Director Freeman, what do you base your opinions on when it comes to opposing this and your belief that this wouldn't have benefits to communities across the state?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the PFA prepares an estimated funding needs report every year. It's available on our website. It's been provided to the chair of this committee and others. The purpose, or one of the tables and sections of that report looks at this issue of per household costs and the specific projects on the list. And the impact of WIF grants for various communities. And there's also a comparison to that $29 figure I mentioned, the average cost of households in the metro area. The real issue comes down to the fact that when we provide grant funding to help offset project costs, so it reduces the amount that a city has to borrow, the cities use that money to reduce the project cost, and then the remainder is paid for the way city enterprise funds pay for these projects, which is through rates that are charged across the entire user base. There is no mechanism for a larger city to say, these grant funds are going to be used to reduce costs for specific categories of users. As far as I know, there's no ability under state law for a water utility to do that. And I have not heard of anybody that's proposing a system to try to do that. So therefore, the way the WIF grant program works is looking at the average cost per user, and that impact of that grant is just naturally more impactful to smaller communities. The impact to larger cities, the grant is diluted because it's spread across so many users within the system.
Representative Ryer.
So, Director Freeman, if we were looking at this new approach and thinking about it from the perspective of individual cities, and I think we would agree that there are large and small cities in the metro and in the rural areas, would you argue, though, that this would be a way to prioritize amongst the many cities, because I am confident that even if you excluded metro areas, you would see a diversity of need, and wouldn't this be a useful way to focus that in, that those allocations, and including in smaller metro communities or even larger ones?
Director Freeman.
Chair Lee, Representative, the WIF program is available to smaller cities, to all cities, really. We calculate potential WIF eligibility for all projects that come through the funding. We provide funding for Minneapolis-St. Paul through very low interest loans for very large projects, and we provide funding to cities big and small throughout the state, oftentimes with WIF grants to help offset the costs. The issue is not the priority, it's the where can the grant funds be used? Where are the grant funds needed for cities to actually make those water improvements that are necessary to maintain their systems and protect public health? Minneapolis and St. Paul and bigger cities have the resources to make the improvements that need to be made. And we work with them to use low interest loans to help offset some of those costs. But the real critical need for maintaining water infrastructure and the danger where it cannot happen because of affordability is really in the smaller communities. And the WIF program doesn't define who's eligible. It defines affordability criteria, but that's how the numbers play out because of the impacts to those smaller user systems.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director. I have a question for Representative Hansen. Representative, could you please clarify then how, from my point of view, my understanding is that there would be a benefit, and I would like to just understand how this would work.
Sure,
concept.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ryer. You know, the easiest thing to do is to keep doing what we've done. And with the new federal dollars coming in, there's an opportunity to be transformative and make changes. Cities have the ability, you know, your water billing comes through the city in most cases in the metro area. You can track where they are in tracks. You could, when the federal dollars come in and when we spend state dollars, that is an investment in a priority. And so I believe we have the ability, the data ability to do that. In addition, you know, if you look in my district, I represent Ryer, my current district, you know, I have South St. Paul and West St. Paul. South St. Paul is a poor community. We also have Lilydale and Mendota, two very small towns right in the middle of the metro area. So the ability, when you are providing assistance, I think that each of the testifiers has spoke for the status quo. They've spoke that this is how we do it, and this is the way we've been doing it. And I think that what we're saying here in this bill is how we can do it differently using the technology and using when we apply for money that a city could show, here we have these census tracts that are in our community that show poverty, and that would raise their prioritization. Now, whether that city is in greater Minnesota or whether it's in the third tier suburb or whether it is one of the core cities, they could show we have this criteria here. We've hit 3 out of the 5, and that moves them up in terms of their dollars. Whereas the median income right now, each of the testifiers has talked that it does provide a bias to the small towns. Now, we can argue whether or not that's appropriate, but it is a bias. And so what I'm trying to do here is say that we try to focus on poverty. And I believe we have the ability to do that. Times have changed. We have much more computing power at our fingertips. We have the ability to work with data. I think the counties can assist in this as well, and the Met Council and the 7-county metro area. For, again, the area that I'm not including, I'm not asking to be included in the bonding bill, I have the lead service line within the Metropolitan Council because they're a different animal. We need to see what we can do across jurisdictions to make sure that we're focusing on providing assistance on a true affordability, which includes a recognition of poverty.
Last follow-up, Rosalind Ryer.
Thank you, Shirley. Yeah, I would just like to close with commenting that to me, we have the opportunity to examine our assumptions and to examine how we've always done things, as Representative Hansen so well put it. And I think that the status quo isn't always our friend when it comes to ensuring equity and ensuring that people across the state, regardless of if they're in Worthington, if they're in Wilmer, or if they're in Minneapolis, all have safe drinking water and can afford to pay for it. And I just want to close by saying I'm a renter. We pay our own water and sewer. The landlord does not pay it. So I will just clarify that one point. And I appreciate all the time, Chair Lee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just heard the comments that here's an opportunity to be transformative, but I've not heard any justification why the status quo is not working. So we don't want to be transformative for the sake of being transformative. So back when I was on city council, we set the water rates as a council for the infrastructure as a whole. Now, out in communities that I serve, not the entire community is on the city sewer water infrastructure. We have, multiple cities that I represent have portions of the city that are on the city sewer water infrastructure, but then a significant portion is still on private well and septic. And so you're having to take the cost of the infrastructure and divide it over not even the entire city, just a portion of the city. And so there's that variable. Another variable is that it is not a good metric to take an area of concentration poverty, for example, as we've heard in the conversation this morning, let's just say in Minneapolis, when they're not isolated, the sewer water infrastructure isn't isolated to just that area of concentrated poverty. They're part of a larger system. And so the city of Minneapolis, for example, is much more the benefactor of having commercial industrial property and other portions of the city, which are on that same system. And so to isolate and use metrics, the three of the five criteria, to use metrics to artificially carve out an area of concentrated poverty and say they are more worthy of a higher priority is to ignore the reality that they have commercial industrial property that the city council has the ability to spread that cost over. Whereas in rural parts of the state, we don't have the commercial industrial base. We don't have the same portions by which the cost can be spread over. And so the status quo in this particular case is absolutely appropriate. We don't want to be transformative just for the sake of, again, transforming. We can't ignore the reality that rural Minnesota and other parts of the state have a more difficult ability to pay than does Minneapolis-St. Paul, even with concentrated areas of poverty, because, again, they are the benefactors of a larger base by which to spread the cost over. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. I have some questions for Director Freeman. So, Director Freeman, according to the EPA implementation guidelines, they said that states have the flexibility to determine our priorities and define what is a disadvantaged community and affordability criteria in a manner that's consistent with federal Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act. So where do Minnesota currently define those definition criteria?
Mr. Chair, the WIF program is a state grant program. So the federal criteria do not directly apply. There is a cross-reference that uses federal affordability or principal forgiveness based on affordability that uses the WIF criteria as well. So there is that connection, but the majority of the projects that are funded from these criteria are state-funded WIF grants. And the reason the federal guidance provides a lot of different options for determining affordability. States have different laws and ways of water utilities structuring rates and structuring project costs, and it's a big country. There's a lot of different ways of doing it. But in Minnesota, the rates are for maintaining the treatment plants and the sanitary sewer collection systems and the wastewater distribution systems and the water towers and all of that serve all the residents. The rates are charged proportionately to all of the users on that system. And I'll say it again, these changes do not change the priority for the WIF grants. They change the eligibility criteria and the way that the grants are determined and targeted. And, you know, we could make changes if we wanted to make changes to give grants to bigger cities, but the impact of that grant is not, there's no way under city rate structures to direct the benefit of that grant to particular low-income communities within the larger city. It reduces the total project costs overall, and the remaining costs are again then spread over all of the users of the system.
So, Director Freeman, so my understanding from what you said then is that we don't necessarily define affordability criteria or disadvantaged community, we do a cross-reference to the WIF program. And so I think what Chair Hansen is doing here is that we're actually, you know, going in there to redefine what is affordable for us and what is a disadvantaged community so that we could take some of these federal funds too. And so I just want to, I don't know if you have it in front of you and for members, you know, point to page 40 of the implementation criteria where the feds actually list out examples of criteria within affordability and disadvantaged communities that can be barriers to water system. And the first bullet point, definition solely based on or contingent upon an unaffordable rate. Some state rate considerations serve to assist in affordability determinations, but others do so in a way that can be a barrier to system with low capacity and poor rate structure. And so I think that based off of that, you know, the definition that we have right now in the WIF program is looking at the medium household income. And so do you not believe that we are, you know, creating barriers for communities in the state of Minnesota to actually receive some of these federal funds?
Mr. Chair, first of all, one correction. The changes in the A2 amendment are to Minnesota Statutes 446A.072. That is the state WIF grant program,
right?
Not the federal principal.
I understand that, Mr. Freeman, but the issue here is the cross-reference. And so do you think that it's more appropriate for us then to actually define these two inside of the Clean Water Fund and the Drinking Water Fund and not the WIF program then?
Mr. Chair, if you're trying to do something to affect the federal principal forgiveness, yes, that would be the proper place to do it. However, I would again emphasize that under the Minnesota rate structure, to identify census tracts that have poverty is a worthy exercise for some purposes, but to determine who gets a grant, the grant doesn't go to that census tract. The grant goes to the city that's operating the entire water system, and the benefit of that grant is spread over all of the users.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. I think that, you know, to your point, this does show the complexity of the issue that we're working with. And, you know, understanding the race structure, you know, in it itself is an issue that we need to take a look at as a legislature too, to understand how, you know, somebody in an area like in my district where the majority of the folks who are, you know, under federal poverty guidelines will be paying for this, you know, the same rate as another, you know, part of the city of Minneapolis when we're in the same water system. And so I appreciate the effort that you have brought for Representative Hansen. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And Director Freeman, just one quick question. Under the current structure that we have, does PFA reach those who are most disadvantaged?
Director Freeman.
Chair Lee, Representative Erdahl, the PFA reaches the communities that need help to maintain their water infrastructure systems. The term disadvantage can be defined in different ways, but right now, working with the PFA programs and the WIF program also allows a partnership with our the federal USDA rural development that focuses on the very small rural communities. Any community that has a water infrastructure need can get on the priority list, work through the application process, and we will find a way to get that project funded. It will be likely expensive. The smaller the community, it's going to be expensive. But the WIF grant will help bring it down to a manageable level. And that's the purpose of the program. It is working the way it was designed.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Freeman. So you say that communities get on the priority list, and just if you would affirm that that's regardless of the size of the community.
Director Freeman.
Chair Lee, Representative Erdahl, yes, regardless of the size of the community. We are right now working with the city of St. Paul. Of course, there's a lead service line project that we're working with them on, but we're also working with them on a major $200 million rehabilitation of the McCarran's Lake drinking water treatment plant that St. Paul Regional Water Service uses to provide water service to the city of St. Paul and many surrounding communities. PFA will be a major financer in that project through the drinking water state revolving fund. We work with cities of all sizes.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Freeman.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this has been a good discussion. I think it's important to note, you know, not all communities in the suburbs are wealthy. Not all communities have the ability to pay for it themselves in the metro. In addition, there are some unique challenges in many parts of the metro, but also in greater Minnesota, with contaminants that affect drinking water. Could be PFAS, could be radium, could be other things, where those communities, which may not have the capacity to pay for it, they look like they have the capacity. So defending the status quo doesn't take into account changes that are occurring and changes that we're discovering with our drinking water and our wastewater. I believe the city of Bemidji, we've had to do a significant amount of infrastructure because of PFAS. Throughout the East Metro, my community of South St. Paul, one of the wells had to be shut down because of radium. Not every community in the metro area is wealthy and has the ability to pay for it themselves. I'd ask for your support and look forward to the continuing conversation.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Next on the agenda is another one of your bill, House File 4433. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 4433 relates to green infrastructure. And I just want to get on the record because on line 2.28, says green infrastructure has the meaning given in the United States Code. So green infrastructure means a range of measures that use plant or soil systems, permeable pavement, and other permeable surfaces or substrates, stormwater harvest and reuse, or landscaping to store, infiltrate, and evaporate stormwater and reduce flows to sewer systems and to surface waters. That is federal law. What 4433 does is it recognizes and defines that in state law and then provides that the revolving loan fund can be used. We would establish a grant program within the PFA and provide $20 million in general obligation bonds and $20 million from the general fund to green infrastructure projects. And at the end of the bill, it describes a couple of those that are green infrastructure. I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And so members, Ms. Crabb from Minneapolis Parks and Rec will be presenting the Minneapolis proposal, which is a proposal that we did see on tour. And so Ms. Crabb, if you could just briefly go over your presentation, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Chair Lee, Representative Hansen, and committee members, I'm Rachel Crabb, Water Resources Supervisor with the Minneapolis Park and Rec Board. Thank you, Chair Lee and Representative Hansen and committee members for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 4433, using funding to build green infrastructure and creating a grants program to fund green infrastructure projects to increase climate resiliency. I'm here today to present an example of the type of project that could be implemented within the Minneapolis Park system that could benefit from a green infrastructure grant program like created by this bill. As members of this committee know, the Minneapolis Park system includes over 6,000 acres of parkland and water. Much of this parkland was set aside next to, around, and to purposefully give park patrons access to the vital lakes and creeks across Minneapolis. Setting aside this land over 100 years ago was visionary for its time. And that act continues to present incredible opportunities today to use green infrastructure to address the realities of climate change while improving water quality and natural resources across the city of Minneapolis. As our state climatology office has determined, our state is experiencing increased rainfall and more frequent flooding. More of our precipitation is falling as rain rather than snow, and freeze-thaw cycles are increasing. In fact, our recent record-breaking wet period saw 7 years' worth of rain fall in 6 years in the metro. This additional full year's equivalent of precipitation creates significant issues for our park infrastructure, specifically because nearly all of that rain falls on Minneapolis crosses a park. On top of that, much of the rain that falls in the western metro suburbs also flows through a Minneapolis park via our three creeks that passing through our city, Shingle Creek, Bassett Creek, and Minnehaha Creek. These three creeks have statewide water quality impact because they all flow to the Mississippi River, which can be a drinking source for some downstream communities. As the stewards of the land along the city's waterways, MPRB is responsible for trails, natural areas, gardens, athletic fields, trees, bridges, sport courts, and many of these areas exist within floodplains or near water. As our waterways flood more frequently and severely, this critical infrastructure is at increased risk of damage. And flooding has already severely eroded the banks of our creeks, which were damaged in the 2014 flood, and then again in 2019, the new wettest year on record. Near our creeks, we have seen pavement and trails degrade, retaining walls fail, and bridge abutments become eroded. All of this has occurred as record-breaking amounts of untreated stormwater flow directly to our waterways. As a solution to address these issues, MPRB has adopted comprehensive master plans created in collaboration with our watershed partners and community members for each of the three creek corridors, taking climate resiliency into consideration. These plans look ahead at predicted rainfall patterns and were designed for future 100-year flood zones rather than current ones. MPRB is ready to implement shoreline and in-stream enhancements like stream remeanders and creation of riffles and pools for habitat enhancement. We would like to modify stormwater outfalls to protect stream banks and relocate and transform trail alignments to avoid regularly flooded areas to preserve pedestrian and bicycle connectivity. We could relocate, reconfigure, or redesign parking lots and roadways where they are impacted by high water. We'll need to raise and redesign bridges for safe and available pedestrian and traffic connections and create flood and stormwater management areas designed to provide water quality benefits. All of these projects could be implemented on existing public parkland where multiple layered benefits of recreation, resiliency, water quality, and habitat improvement can be realized. These plans were created after an extensive two-year process of community engagement and specific collaboration with each of our local watershed districts, watershed management organizations, and the City of Minneapolis. Our plans have now been adopted by the Park Board of Commissioners. However, these infrastructure needs greatly exceed the funding that exists from our tax levy, local bond funding, regional bonding, regional O&M funds, or even from parks and legacy funding. Funding from the state general obligation bond may be needed unless grant programs such as this one are created to close the gap. Flooding and stormwater issues cross all political boundaries, and they originate both from within and far beyond Minneapolis. Non-action on solving these issues will have an impact to the Mississippi River, which is a resource for the entire state, as increased rainfall brings increasing pollution downstream. MPRB's desire is to secure funding to implement nearly all of the master plan identified resiliency and green infrastructure projects in the Shingle Creek Corridor in North Minneapolis, the Bassett Creek Corridor in Near North, as these creeks have shorter runs through the city and have not seen the same level of investment over time. We desire to secure funding to implement about 40% of the needed projects across the Minnehaha Creek Corridor. MPRB is prepared to match designated allocations from regional funds allocated through the Metropolitan Council, as well as some local funds designated for connected neighborhood parks. Local watershed organizations for Shingle, Bassett, and Minnehaha Creeks were integrated into the planning process.
Can I have you wrap up, please?
And absolutely. And collaborations for all three creek corridors are being explored. This comprehensive project, accomplished entirely on public land, will have significant infrastructure and habitat benefits in Minneapolis, the region, and the state, which bills like House File 4433 can help address. Thank you to the committee for letting me speak on the project today.
Thank you, Ms. Crabb. Next on the agenda is Director Freeman. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. There is no doubt that green infrastructure is an important component of the overall water infrastructure needs and specifically to deal with urban stormwater.
Under federal law for the state revolving funds, eligible green infrastructure projects include stormwater projects, but also include energy efficiency, energy conservation, and renewable energy components. These projects go through the same process. They apply to the Pollution Control Agency for ranking on the project priority list. They have all in the past ranked in the fundable range, and they follow the same application process. PFA has funded these projects, all of the green infrastructure projects that have applied and followed through the funding process. We have provided funding through the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. And that includes a project that we funded, I believe, in 2012 for the city of Minneapolis, I think it was called the Minneapolis Greenway Project. These are good projects. We would be happy to fund more of them. I look forward to seeing proposals from the city for some of the work that was just described. With the additional federal infrastructure funds, we have more resources, and I would fully expect that we will continue to be able to fund all of the green infrastructure projects that come through our funding process. This bill is not necessary for PFA to provide funding for these projects. The bill also creates a new green infrastructure grant program to be administered by the PFA. However, the PFA is a very small agency that provides funding based on project eligibilities and priorities determined by the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department. PFA does not have staff capacity or expertise to administer a separate grant program such as this. I respectfully request that if the legislature wants to create a green infrastructure grant program, that it be assigned to a more appropriate agency.
Thank you, Director Freeman. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Chair Hansen, for this proposal. Next up, and the last bill of the agenda, House File 4715, Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's been quite a journey this morning, but this is a good bill. This bill expands the state building energy loan program and expands it so that solar energy installations can be done at our state parks. So as we've heard on this committee, and we've toured the state and we've seen in person, of course, there's so many buildings that are in our DNR and in our public realm. So what we're trying to do here is to expand it, the program, so that some of these solar and energy efficiency projects can be done on our own state park system. And it makes sense environmentally, and certainly there would be, ideally there's cost savings to Minnesotans as we meet these. The bill, it needs a little bit of work, and I'm looking forward to hearing the testimony that we have after me. But there's we need to kind of work on maybe shifting it from a loan program to a direct appropriation to make some of it a little bit more successful. But I think we can get there, and it's certainly a great discussion. It makes a lot of sense with the federal money and to expand this program. And so I have a couple folks that are here today this morning, and Chair Lee, if that's okay with you, I'd like to hear from them, and then we can hear their input. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, just a heads up, we are over a minute, but we have 7 more minutes left of the hearing. And so, Mr. Korsberg, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Andrew Korsberg, and I'm the Policy and Planning Supervisor for DNR Parks and Trails. Thanks for the chance to speak to this bill. At DNR, we're very interested in making investments in energy conservation as well as solar energy. As Representative Lilly sort of commented on, the revolving loan program may be a little bit challenging for Parks and Trails to be able to make full use of it, especially given the payback needs. For example, the program requirements for a maximum payback period of 7 years would be challenging for us if we were using energy savings to repay the loan. Currently, our total annual expenditures in state parks on energy is about $1.2 million. So that it may be a little bit challenging. For comparison, it's my understanding that solar projects often have a simple payback period or return on investment of about 20 or 30 years. So while the $25 million is a significant investment, I'm not sure that we'd have enough energy projects at this time that could fully qualify for the program as it's established now. But we could, you know, certainly use the $25 million to invest in alternative energy and energy conservation. But like I mentioned, you know, it'd be extremely difficult to utilize the loan aspect of the program given that payback period. So, you know, that said, we're definitely interested in working with Representative Lilly and others to learn more and collaborate on ways to improve alternative energy and conservation in state parks. So thank you very much for the chance to speak to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Korsberg. Next on the agenda, Mr. O'Grady.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Logan O'Grady. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We are not often in this committee, so for those unfamiliar with MNSEA, we're a 501c6 trade organization. We represent over 140 member companies within the solar and energy storage industries in Minnesota. Most of our members are small businesses with less than 40 employees. And the best thing that we can do for all Minnesota small businesses, but particularly those in the relatively nascent solar industry, is send strong market signals via legislation that Minnesota is a great place to do business for solar entrepreneurs. So thank you, Representative Lilly, for authoring this bill. This creates a great public-private partnership between the state and the solar industry. This partnership will create hundreds of jobs while saving the state and taxpayers money. Because our state facilities will now own rather than rent their energy from utilities indefinitely. We have successfully applied this same approach before. The bipartisan Solar for Schools program from last year has been extremely popular, especially in greater Minnesota, and demand has far exceeded the funding for that program. This year, we're happy to work with Representative Ryer to expand the program to public buildings so our local units of government can benefit from solar too, lower energy costs for our cities and counties, and save local taxpayer dollars. This bill is just one way the solar and energy storage industries will partner with the state to build the grid of the 21st century. This grid will be cleaner, more resilient, more efficient, more cost-effective, and more democratic than before. So thank you again, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lilly. Looking forward to working with our state agencies and you as we continue to move this bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. O'Grady. I see no questions. Chair Lilly, quick closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for getting us in this morning. And I think it's important to do these things in our public facilities. We're hearing that, you know, all morning we've been hearing it on from Representative Hansen's bills, and then Ms. Ryers, Representative Ryers, has a project she's working on. But we can definitely lead on this, and appreciate your time this morning, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lilly, and thank you, members, for coming in early and staying late for us to go through our agenda today. I really appreciate all the efforts. Before we go into break, just a heads up that we will be coming back, and the next meeting will be on Tuesday, April 19th, so please look out for the committee schedule over break. I just want to wish you all an early happy Easter, and have a good break, everyone. This meeting is adjourned.